Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And stay tuned for tonight's special report on the subject of property when we come back. You know, many of the lessons that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week school and courtroom strategy and procedure. And this class includes lessons that range from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, a summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits and evidence, write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. And there are 28 essential elements that you need to master now in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn those here at the law school in this class. If you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, last time we were talking about adhesion contracts as we're relating this subject to property, and I mentioned to you last time as an illustration, that what we're dealing with here isn't the physical rocks, mineral, and earth, per se. We're dealing with the rights that attach to the property. Now, your labor is a right. You have a right to your labor. Let me show you that. When we look at labor and labor relations, we find that labor isn't something that government can take from you. It's something that you have to give to government in order for them to utilize it. In labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense, as including those who toil with their brains, as well as those performing manual work. So you may be a professional, a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, or something like that, and you don't go out and get calluses on your hand. But your labor, your mental use of your bodily processes used for your betterment or your benefit belongs to you. It's your intellectual property. Just as much as the laborer out here swinging a pick, you know, collecting his wages at the end of the day. Now, there's a constitutional protection to your right to work. Now, when you took your job at General Motors, they said, we'll give you $10 an hour. You work 40 hours a week. At the end of the week, you ought to get paid $400, you know, if you do your arithmetic. But you don't get paid $400. You get paid about $310. So the question arises, what happened to that other 90 bucks? Well, we had to pay our taxes. Well, wait a minute. If you had to pay those taxes and government has the power to take that $90 away from you, then obviously you don't have that property right, do you? If somebody else can take it away from you against your will and over your objection, take it away. But you had to alienate yourself from that $90. How did you alienate yourself from that $90 that went for Social Security and all these taxes? Now, the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. Every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own industry. Got that, boys and girls? You have a natural right to the fruits of your own injury, or your own industry. Now, labor is deemed to be property. Labor is deemed to be property, especially within the meaning of constitutional guarantees. Thus, the right to acquire property includes the right to acquire property by labor. The right to earn wages is just as much property and within the protection of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution as are earned wages. Now, since the right to labor is protected by the 14th Amendment and numerous guarantees of state constitutions, you cannot be deprived of such right by arbitrary mandate of the legislature, and it merits legal protection. Such right is likewise embraced by the 5th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. So you got a right to your labor, but something happened here, boys and girls. You know as well as I do, you're going out here and work 40 hours at 10 bucks an hour, you ain't getting 400 bucks. And the reason you're not is because you signed a contract. Now, you can sit there and say, yeah, but if I don't do that, they won't hire me. That's true. Well, do not. You go down to McDonald's and tell them you want a job without a social security number, and they're going to tell you kiss off. But here's the point. Nobody can make you work for McDonald's, and nobody can take your wages away from you. You have to volunteer to do that. Now, if McDonald's is saying to you, well, we'll pay you $10 an hour, but we're only going to give you $8 of it. And if you agree to that, well, that's your thing in life. I just happened to come on the scene, and I said, well, if I work for $10 an hour, I want the $10. I ain't giving it to anybody. And that's the end of the report. Now, government comes along and says, oh, no, you got to pay your taxes. I don't want to contract with you, government, and I don't want to do business with you. I don't do business with the mafia because it's a criminal enterprise, and I don't do business with government because it's a criminal enterprise. Boys and girls, the Ten Commandment model requires that we stop doing criminal business with criminal institutions. And government is a criminal institution. Violates the First Commandment coming right out of the chute. So government comes along and says, well, what we got to do is we got to make a package up here that looks so good that these people will voluntarily give up their right to labor. When they've done it, hell, it works like a shot. Worked with me. I wanted to deliver papers for the Humboldt Standard, and they said, you join Social Security or you can't be a paper boy. And I said, well, I want to be a paper boy so bad that I will give up my freedom and my property rights to become a paper boy. And they said, that's what we require. You give up your rights and your freedoms, and we'll let you be a paper boy. And that's all the rest of you people have done. You said, well, I want to work for General Motors, and I'll give up my rights and freedoms to do that. And you did. So quit complaining. Now, if you never get to a point in your life where you say, you know, I'm not so sure that that was a good idea. I mentioned to you last time, you know, when we were talking about mortgages, did you wake up to the fact that maybe paying this mortgage or making this mortgage and paying this interest over here hasn't been one of your better financial decisions? I mean, if you bought a house for $300,000 and today it's worth $200,000 and you're still making the payments on a $300,000 mortgage that covers a $200,000 house, are you telling me that that was one of your better financial strategies? Huh? It was a good financial strategy for Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, but it didn't make you any money. But you thought it was going to, and they told you it was going to. Did you buy one of those collateralized debt obligations? And did you buy into these subprime mortgages as an investment called 3A, and then later you found out that it was less than BBB, it was junk, and now it's underwater, and now you haven't got the house, you haven't got your money, and the thing is in default, you're living in Abu Dhabi, and the house that you bought is in Long Beach, California. Do you mean to tell me, Sheikh, that that's one of your better financial decisions? Boys and girls, when God told us, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, he was not whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Now it's come back to bite all of us in the butt. Now the people that made out like bandits are guys like Bank of America and Goldman Sachs. I mean the fraudsters that sold this crap, they made a lot of money. But there's an Achilles heel for the banksters in this. Not only did they alienate themselves from the houses when they made their profits, they don't own those houses. They don't have a deed to it. Remember they sold that to the Sheikh in Abu Dhabi, and you're sitting in the house. Now, if you could learn how to take advantage of your common law position under the Constitution, you could stay in that house and get a court-ordered deed and take the house and not pay any more on it. There was a guy on Lair the other night, I was kind of laughing. He bought a condominium up in Seattle, Washington for $200,000 or $300,000. I don't know what it was. Some god-awful, ridiculous price. But anyway, he put his down payment on it. It was $25,000, as I recall. And he was being interviewed by Paul Solomon, and he quit making his payments, I think it was 27 months ago. And he's lived in this place for 27 months without paying the mortgage. And they haven't kicked him out yet. Now, he didn't know why they hadn't kicked him out. He couldn't figure that out. I know why they didn't kick him out, because they don't own the house. They sold it in a CDO. And the guy that bought it over in Rheinsberg, Germany or someplace, he doesn't know how to kick the guy out. And the guy that's in there, he's just eating it up. He's kind of like a tenant, you know, that doesn't pay his rent. And now Bank of America woke up to that. And so they're going to try to recoup. They've offered all you people out there that have Bank of America mortgages. They're going to have you come in and sign a new contract on giving them that house back. They want your power of attorney so that they can evict you from. Well, right now it's nobody's house, but you're in it, and so you've got the highest and best claim to it because you're little Georgie walking up the street with the bread and milk, and Daddy doesn't own it because he doesn't have the deed to it, and Harry Connick alienated his rights to it, and so you're in possession, you actually own it. And you could perfect your title. You could. It's called a quiet title action. Quiet title. You might want to think about that a little bit and see if maybe that's got some merit. Now, last time we were talking about this thing of adhesion contracts. Now, adhesion contracts are just exactly what Bank of America is offering you people out there. See, they're not telling you all of the story. They're not telling you about the CDO and the fraud that went into it and how they don't own the house and the guy they sold the CDO to doesn't own the house and you probably have the highest and best evidence of title by possession and so on. They're not telling you that. So they come along, they make you an offer, don't give you all the salient information, and you're ignorant, been to public school, and so you're going to go down there and sign that new contract, which now will give them the right to throw you out. I liked old Josiah Stamp. He's the guy that wrote that little piece, you know, and he said, these bankers over here, you give them the power to create money, and they'll create it all again and take it all back. Let me read that to you. Josiah Stamp, he was the president of the Bank of England, a banker, one of the banksters over here. He says, banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the world. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money. And with the flick of a pen, they'll create enough money to buy it all back again. Now take this great power away from these bankers, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, because this would then be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let them continue to create money. And just keep voting in Team A and Team B so that they can bail out Bank of America and Goldman Sachs. God love them, huh? Now remember the development of large-scale enterprise here in the United States, and it's not just here, it's around the world with these multinational corporations and its mass production and distribution systems, inevitably led to a standardized mass contract. The usefulness of these standardized mass contracts was discovered in the banking, insurance, and transportation businesses, and their use spread to all other fields of large-scale enterprise, into international as well as national trade, and into labor relations. The uniformity of terms of contracts became an important factor in the precise calculation of risks. Risks, which are difficult to calculate, can be eliminated altogether. The standard clauses in insurance policies are the most striking examples of this attempt to select and to control risks that are assumed under contract. Let me give you an illustration. Here in the United States, a few years back, we had a big hurricane called Katrina. And it devastated the Gulf Coast of the United States from about Mobile, Alabama, over to about New Orleans, along in there. And people down there, they lost their homes, and they were washed away and blown away. So, you know, the people down there on the Gulf Coast, knowing that they're in Hurricane Alley, banks and other institutions require those people to buy hurricane insurance, just like fire insurance or anything else. And these people buy hurricane insurance to protect them from the distinct possibility that their house may be damaged or destroyed by a hurricane. Now, nobody up here where I live, you know, about 500 miles from the Gulf Coast, buys any hurricane insurance. Why would anybody here buy hurricane insurance? We don't have hurricanes here. So the only people who want to buy hurricane insurance are the people that live on the coast where the hurricanes occur. So it's a very limited audience. So the hurricane insurance is high-priced. Has to be. To limit the price, the insurance companies put a clause in the policy that says, we do not pay for water damage. Okay, so the salesman comes along and he says, oh, Bob, you have a house right here on the Gulf Coast and you're in danger of a hurricane. Let me sell you hurricane insurance because the bank requires it and you want it because it's the logical thing to do because you've been to public school and you don't believe you can live without insurance. And Bob says, well, of course I can't live without insurance. I wouldn't think of practicing strict liability. That's something that comes from the Bible and I wouldn't want to have anything to do with something like that. So sell me an insurance policy. So the agent sells Bob the insurance policy. Clause 18 says we don't pay for water damage. Now, Hurricane Katrina comes along and washes this guy's house away. And the guy says, well, there it is. My house has been washed away. He rushes down to the claims window of the insurance company and says, hey, pay me my money so I can rebuild my house. And the insurance underwriter says, well, what happened to your house? And Bob says, it washed away in the hurricane. And then the claims manager says, oh, it washed away? Yeah, there was a big tidal surge, came right up, washed my house away. And then the insurance agent says, oh, do you have flood insurance or a rider to cover the flood? And the guy says, huh? Yeah. See, we pay for hurricane damage. If your house blew away, we'd write you a check today. But since it washed away, we don't pay for water damage. And what the agent in the insurance company doesn't tell you is that 90% of the damage from a hurricane comes from water. That's a classic example of an adhesion contract. You have to buy it because it's the law. It's like auto insurance. You have to buy it. But after you buy it, if you have a claim, we don't pay claims. So 90% of the people down there on the Gulf Coast don't get paid from the insurance industry. Are these people incensed and will they refuse to buy insurance? No, 1,000 times no. They go to the bank and the bank says, if you want me to loan you money to rebuild your house that you now have to go into debt to buy, to pay for, because the insurance company won't pay on your insurance claim, we will not sell you, we will not give you, we will not make a loan to you until you have hurricane insurance. And so Bob runs down, he buys more hurricane insurance that by now he should know that if there's a hurricane, they're not going to pay for. You can pay your premiums, but you can't collect. Which leads me to ask the question, why in hell would you want hurricane insurance if you can't collect in a hurricane? So now you've got to buy the more expensive and actually limiting flood insurance. That makes the policy so expensive that it ain't worth buying, which is why nobody buys the flood insurance, because up here where I'm at, in order for you to have insurance, you have to have a lot of people paying into the pool who are never going to collect. You see, the 10% of the people down there whose houses washed away, those houses had to be paid for by the 90% of the people who bought the policies and didn't collect. That's why we have Clause 18 in there, and that's why we don't tell you about it. That's just typical. Now, why you people want to do business with these corporations, these banks, and these governments is fully obvious. It's the only thing you know. You've been taught and trained to do that. And you're going to continue to do that because it's the only thing you know. So that's why I thought, well, let me come on the air and tell you that there's another model over here. It's called the Ten Commandment Model. And with the Ten Commandment Model, we're not going to buy any insurance at all. And we are going to rely upon the Guardian Angel Program, which is outlined in Matthew 4, verse 6, and the Tithing Program, which is laid out in Malachi 3, verse 8. We're going to practice a different model. And then when the hurricane comes, it's not going to blow your house down or wash your house away. And that's because God himself has to protect your house. And I get asked that quite often. Well, what makes you think God is going to protect your house? Well, because I'm practicing his law. I got a contract with God himself. When I tell people I have a contract with God, they kind of look at me and say, you know, I think you need to be locked up in a mental hospital. Let me show you where this contract with God comes from. There's 33 articulable benefits that you're entitled to under this contract. You're entitled to rain in due season. I'll read them off to you. You're entitled to rain in due season. Hurricane Katrina is not rain in due season. The land shall yield or increase. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your stores of goods shall not run out. There will be no famine or shortages. You shall dwell in your land safely. I will give you peace in the land. I will rid evil beasts from the land. You shall have no war in your land. You shall chase your enemies. They shall fall before you by the sword. I will have respect to you. I will make you fruitful and multiply you. I will establish my covenant with you. I will establish my contract with you, is what that says. I will set my tabernacle among you. So if you're wondering, well, where did you get your contract with God? Well, I got it from Leviticus 26, verse 9. That's my contract. I will set my tabernacle among you. My soul shall not abhor you. I will be your God. You will be my people. Translated, that means I will be your sovereign and you will be my subject. I will be your king. You will be my servant. You will be set above all nations on earth. You will be blessed in the city. You will be blessed in the fruit of your body. You will be blessed in the fruit of your cattle. You will be blessed when you come in, and you will be blessed when you go out. Your house washing away in Biloxi, Mississippi is not a blessing. That's a curse. You will be blessed in everything you do. That's a pretty neat one. You will be a holy people to God. All of the people of the earth will be afraid of you. You shall lend, but not borrow. See, I don't have a bank account. I don't have a mortgage. I lend, but I don't borrow. I practice the Ten Commandment model. People who practice the Ten Plank model borrow and don't lend. You will be the head and not the tail in everything that you do. I will take sickness away from you. 70 years, all of your days will be fulfilled. That's 70 years. You will live to be 70 years old, 25,550 days, trouble-free with no sickness or disease. You will inherit the land. You will gain great wealth. Would you like to gain great wealth? That's why I like this Ten Commandment model so well. It just makes money hand over fist. I'm telling you, I think the Ten Commandment model is the greatest thing since sliced white bread. If God made anything better than the Ten Commandment model, he kept it for himself. Multiplied gold and silver and herds and flocks. I like that one, too. He's got a lot of neat benefits over here, but they don't include insurance, mortgages, interest, usury, banking, income tax, Social Security. You know those 108 benefits? Those 108 benefits that you get under Social Security, God doesn't give you any of those. No workman's compensation, no unemployment insurance. If you're unemployed, you have to go find another job. That's one of the downsides. I'm just, you know, got to be honest with you. And if your house were to blow away, people ask me that. They said, well, what if a tornado came, Mr. Gordon, and blew your house away? I'd have to go build another one all by myself. And then they say, well, where are you going to get the money to build this new house? I'm going to get it out of my insurance can. Remember, I didn't pay any insurance premiums, so I put my insurance premiums into my own can. Well, what the hell? You people down on the Gulf Coast, you paid your premiums and the insurance company took it. And you didn't get any money from the claim to build your house. At least I've got my premiums over here to rebuild my house. You ain't got jack squat, partner. Now sit there and preach me a sermon. Tell me how good insurance is. Now, insurance is good for the guy that collects. I don't deny that. It's kind of like the lottery. The lottery is good for the guy that collects. It's just that your chances of collecting are 83 or 84 million to one. I never have bought a lottery ticket. Never have. If I live to be 110... I hope that I live to be 110 without ever having bought a lottery ticket. Guy told me one time, he says, you can't win without buying a lottery ticket. Well, partner, I can't lose by not buying one. So, out of this also came the widespread use of warranty clauses in the machine industry, which limits the common law remedies of the buyer to a breach of an implied warranty of quality, and particularly his right to claim damages. These standardized contracts have thus become an important means of excluding or controlling the irrational factor of a jury in litigation, and they belong in the same category as codifications. Do you get that? It eliminates faulty jury decisions and houses being washed away in Hurricane Katrina. Guarantees us we'll collect the premiums and pay nothing out. It's a hell of a deal. And I'm not opposed to the insurance industry screwing all you people. Now, don't get me wrong, you insurance people out there. You know, I'm not opposed to you stealing from all these people. If they're dumb enough to keep coming back and paying you and to screw them over, you know, well, they're the proximate cause of their own injury. That's what any court would say, any judge would say. Well, you mean you went back after you got screwed once and you bought it again? You, like the dog returning to his vomit, went back a second time? Talk about foolishness now. At this juncture of time, let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, non-state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's 417-273-4967. All right, now I've got to give you a little bit more here. The source of information that we use in this program, or the sources, I should say, are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour gives credit to those authors and publications when we use their material on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, we invite you to go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about property, the subject of property, you can't have freedom. You can't have liberty without property. So in 1933, our Congress and the President working together said, now how are we going to take the freedom and the property away from the American people? And said, well, what we got to do is get them to sign up to a contract. So they wrote up the Social Security contract, and in the contract it says, we're going to give you all these neat benefits. What we didn't tell you was Clause 18. They didn't tell you the whole story. That's why I invited you. I said, why don't you go read your contract and then see what it is that you're obligated to. Yeah, it gives you these 108 benefits, but you have to pay retail plus 10 to get them. You're not getting anything free out of Social Security. To give you an illustration on Social Security, for instance, let's suppose you're a professional guy. And let's just suppose, for the sake of our discussion, you're making $100,000 a year or more. Which, you know, for you professionals out there, that shouldn't be too big a trick. You know, especially if you got your old lady working. Between the two of you, you should be making $100,000, $200,000 a year. Now, here's what happens to you. You have to pay in the maximum rate of Social Security taxes. So you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, you know, or an engineer, or real estate broker, or something like that, and you're making money, just doing your thing in life, paying in the maximum. Now, take your EL-1197G3 computer, you know, your little calculator here on your desk, and take a look at the amount of money that you pay in every month, multiply that times 12. Can you do that, Bobby? And that'll tell you how much you're annually paying into Social Security. Multiply that times 40. You know, from the time you got out of college at age 22 until you retire at age 62 or something on that order, you're going to pay into Social Security for about 40 years. Now take your annual payments and multiply that times 40, and that'll tell you how much money you're going to pay into Social Security at the current rate. And as a professional paying in the maximum, you're going to pay in $525,000. I already calculated it for you, Bobby. It's okay, but why don't you do it for yourself, and then you'll know that I didn't lie to you. Now, ask yourself the question, under current law, how much can you draw out? And the answer is $1,200 a month. You're going to get $1,200 a month forever, Bob, or until you die. If you don't die, you will collect that $1,200 a month forever. At $1,200 a month, let's take $525,000 and divide that by 1,200. If you live 437 months when you turn 65 and you start drawing, or 62, if you start drawing out and you live for 437 months, you will get all of your money back. Now, if you're average, though, you're only going to live for 120 months, 10 years, 65 to 75. The average American dies at about 75.6. Now, if you divide 437 months by 12, that means that after you retire, you have to live 36 years. So if you retired at age 65, 75, 85, 95, 101, if you live to be 101, you'll get your money back. How many people live to be 101, Bobby? I'm not saying that you won't be one of them, but I'm just saying, on average. You see how insurance works? These guys aren't dumb. They just simply say, look, we just take the averages over here, do the arithmetic, and here's how much money we're going to make. And they eliminate the irrational factor. They just simply say everybody has to pay in. So they got everybody paying into Social Security, and you rich guys out there, you moneymakers, you professionals, you're paying in the most, the maximum rate. And on that maximum rate, here's how much you're going to collect. You're going to collect $1,200 a month times 120 months. And so you're going to collect $144,000 out of your $525,000. So over 40 years, you're going to pay in $525,000. You're going to collect about $150,000. What that means is that you're paying in $525,000, take off $144,000. You're going to pay an extra $381,000 to have 120 checks issued to you. Now, if you were to divide that $381,000 by 120 months, you have to pay $3,175 for each check that Social Security is going to write to you for those 120 checks. Let me ask you this, Mr. Professional Man. Are you so damn incompetent that you need to pay somebody $3,175 to write you a $1,200 check? Huh? I mean, you can go out here and cut somebody's brains out. You can operate on them. You can medicate them. You can give them legal advice, no matter how poor it is. And you can make $100,000 a year, but you've got to pay some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. $3,000 to write you a $1,200 check? Are you so damn incompetent that you can't take care of yourself? I mean, surely you people must be kidding, aren't you? Now, it's not quite that bad, you know, if you're a blue-collar worker. And it's not quite that bad if you're a poor guy flipping burgers at McDonald's. If you're at McDonald's, you'll pay in a dollar and collect 68 cents. And if you're a blue-collar worker, you'll pay in a dollar and collect about 38 cents, I think it is, 40 cents. And then here, if you're a professional over here, you'll pay in a dollar, and I think you collect 5 cents. Isn't that 5 cents off of the? Well, let me just figure it out. $144,000 is what you're going to collect divided by 525. 27. You'll collect 27%. That's why Social Security is such a bad deal. The Ten Commandment model is the better program to follow. That way, Mr. Professional Man, over the course of 40 years, you will have that $525,000 to invest any way you want to. Now, if you invest it poorly and you lose it all, tough titty. But if you invest it correctly, put it in a coffee can and just save it, at least you'll have $525,000. Now, let's figure this out. If you just saved the money, $525,000, and you divided that by 120 checks, you'd have a check for $4,375 a month for the rest of your life if you just saved it and stuck it in the can. Don't have to invest it in anything. You don't have to have any interest or jack squat. You'd have $4,375 a month just by saving your money. Now, that's why I say the Ten Commandment model is a better model to work off of, because it provides more for you, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. Now, it is not good for insurance executives, politicians, and bankers, because the parasites will all die without you hosts supporting them. Bank of America cannot survive without you, the host. So if you want to support Bank of America, you know, get after it. But I took a look at it and said, I don't want to do that. I don't give a rat's ass whether Goldman Sachs goes upside down with Lehman Brothers and the rest of them or not. I couldn't care less. I'm just totally selfish. Now your president, your politicians, you know, they get their campaign contributions from these big banks and pharmaceutical companies, and they need these big corporations. And I don't deny that. If you're a politician, the last thing you want to do is practice the Ten Commandment model. You want the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. It's your bread and butter. All ticks need a dog's ear to feed off of. But I'm the dog's ear and I don't need a tick. Dogs don't need ticks. Ticks need dogs. Now let me show you something here about this widespread use of warranty clauses in the machine industry, limiting the common law remedies of a buyer to the breach of an implied warranty of quality. Let me show you how this works. You go into Walmart and you want to buy a toaster. And you look around and you find this General Electric toaster. And you say, boy, this really looks like a neat toaster. So you go and you buy it. And the clerk over here says to you, hey, wait a minute, wait. You see this warranty card inside here? Fill this out, Bob. And send this in to the General Electric Company in Schenectady, New York. Now, maybe you're dumb, and you really don't know what the hell a warranty card is, so you ask the clerk, well, what is a warranty card, you say? And the clerk says, well, it's your guarantee. You see, let's suppose that this toaster goes haywire, and you want it replaced. You send the toaster to Schenectady, New York, to General Electric, and they'll send you a new toaster or fix this one. See, it says right here on the warranty card, this warranty is good for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, and if anything goes wrong, you send it in, and we'll give you a new toaster, or we'll repair this one at no cost to you whatsoever. What are they appealing to? Greed. Hell, I don't want to buy a toaster and the damn thing burns up and I get stuck with it. I want General Electric to guarantee their toaster. I want that warranty. I want that benefit. So you fill out the card and you send it in. Now, let me suggest to you that you go to a legal dictionary, just any law dictionary. Bouvier is the one I prefer. Look up the word warranty and look up the word guarantee. Are those synonymous terms? It is true that a warranty is a guarantee, but it is not true that a guarantee is a warranty. It's kind of like, it is true that all Californians are Americans, but it is not true that all Americans are Californians. It is true that you can walk into a Venus flytrap. It is not true that you can walk out. Now, that's the way this game is played. So General Electric doesn't give you a guarantee. A guarantee is a unilateral promise. Unilateral. That means just me. So if I said to you, I'm going to guarantee my toaster, and if anything goes wrong with it, I'll replace it or I'll fix it. That's a unilateral guarantee. But a warranty is a bilateral agreement. Bilateral. That means it's you and me making a contract. So a warranty is a contract. It's better than that. It's an adhesion contract. It's a contract where General Electric writes the contract. And you don't get to read it. You get to sign up to it. You get to agree to it. You agree that you'll waive your rights under it. But you don't know what your rights are, if any. So the way that works is General Electric writes up this warranty and they file it with the Secretary of State there in Albany, New York. And in the warranty, they put in a clause in there that says, in the event that the consumer plugs this toaster in and it kills him deader than a popcorn fart, he waives all rights to wrongful death. And the limitations or the liability of General Electric is limited to replacement or repair of the toaster. Now you see, under the common law, if I were to sell you that toaster and it killed you, you'd have an action against me for wrongful death. So I don't want you to sue me for wrongful death. I don't want to pay you and your family $1 million for your death because I sold you a faulty product. So I need to get you to agree with me in a contract. Now, if I came to you and said, I want you to sign this contract that limits my liability to replacement of the toaster or repair of the toaster, and if it kills you, you agree that you won't sue me. Hell, you wouldn't sign that, would you? So what I have to do is I have to get you to sign onto a contract that you don't know the terms and conditions of. And that's why the credit card companies, when they write out a contract, they write it out in real fine print or in font that you can't read and hurt your eyes so that you won't read it. That's why I said, what you need to do is to buy yourself a 10-power loop. You go into any coin store and tell them you want a 10-power loop. Cost you $30. Listen, that $30 will pay for itself 100 times over in the first year. God, you'll be amazed. Now, I did a little better than that. I got a 10-power loop. I'm a coin collector and I like to look at them, you know, with both hands. So it goes right over your head. It's got a loop and it's got an adjustment on it, and it's a visor and it goes up and down. And I can inspect my coins with my 10-power loop. I call it my lawyer or my contract glass. And I read my contracts with it. So I stick on my 10-power loop and then I read these contracts. God, what an education that is. You wait, you people down on the Gulf Coast, go into your local coin store and get yourself one of these hood visor type 10-power loops and then read your insurance policy. Boy, are you going to be surprised. Pay special attention to Clause 18. You know, the one that says, if we have a hurricane and your house is washed away, we don't pay. If it blows away, we'll write you a check today. 10% of the houses blow away, 90% of them wash away, and that's why they make so much money and where they get the money to pay for the 10% that wash away. And you 10% that wash away had to pay for the extra insurance, and so they got the money for you up front, or from you up front when they paid your claim. Insurance is a neat business. Not quite as good as banking, but it's a neat business. Banking is good. Not quite as good as pharmaceuticals, but it's a good business. Now, pharmaceuticals is a good business. Not quite as good as farming, but it's a good business. And you farmers are sitting out there saying, farming? Well, I'm going broke. The only people who could go broke farming, which has an 87,200% return attached to it, would be a farmer who practices the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Any farmer that practices the Ten Commandment model will get rich. And every farmer that practices the 10 plank model will stand in line, share the shortage, and go broke. That's the way that game is played. So I thought I'd share with you this. Out of this also came the widespread use of warranty clauses in the machine industry. A warranty. Now, you've been taught and trained from the time you're a little kid, always fill out your warranty cards. I don't have any warranty cards. I don't fill out any warranty cards, and I don't sign contracts with anybody. How do you like that? And I put my insurance premiums into my own can. I have the Gordon Insurance Company, and I'm also in the utility business. I run the Gordon Utility Company, too. It pays off real well. Now, it was popularized here in the United States, where one predominant unilateral will dictates its law to an undetermined multitude rather than to an individual. So whenever you're doing business at Walmart, that's Walmart dictating to you. You and Walmart are not equals. And when you work and you're a member of the union, that's one predominant unilateral will which dictates its law to you. I'm not telling you to drop out of the union. I'm just telling you there's no liberty in the union. If you want to be directed, if you need somebody to tell you when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed at night and what to do in between, I can't think of a better program than corporate America and a labor union. That's the place you want to go. They've got it. And if you're there, stick with it. But if you've been looking at this and you say to yourself, is there something else out there that might be as good as or perhaps even just a tad bit better, let me recommend that Ten Commandment model once more so that you can avoid this predominant unilateral will which dictates its law to an undetermined multitude rather than to an individual. As in all employment contracts of big industry, transportation contracts of big railroad companies, and all those contracts which, as the Romans said, resemble a law much more than a meeting of the minds. Frankly, I prefer contracting with people where you and I can sit down and hammer out an agreement. This program, by the way, this unilateral program of contracts of adhesion, this term contract of adhesion was first used in the United States by Patterson. It was called the delivery of a life insurance policy, and it's reported in 33 Harvard Law Review on page 198, first published in 1919. It was popularized in the United States by scholars who were educated on the continent of Europe and who later taught in this country. This comes from Kessler on contracts of adhesion from the 43rd Columbia Law Review, page 629, first published in 1943. These are called contracts of adhesion. Now, adhesion contracts have at least three indices, which may even appear in combination. The first is bargaining over terms may not be between equals. One party may have such a strong economic power that it can dictate its terms to the weaker party. Second, there may be no opportunity to bargain over the terms at all. This contract of adhesion may be a take-it-or-leave-it proposition in which the only alternatives are adherence or rejection. And third, one party may be totally unfamiliar with the terms. One party may have the advantage of time and expert advice in preparing the contract, while the other party may have no real opportunity to study it. This could even be compounded by use of fine print and convoluted clauses. Did you people hear that? I'm going to cover it one more time in case you missed it. Listen up. A contract of adhesion has three salient points. This is your labor union contract, that warranty in the box from General Electric, your driver's license, marriage license, birth certificate. Contracts of adhesion have three indicia which appear in combination. Bargaining over terms may not be between equals. One party may have such a strong economic power that it can dictate its terms to the weaker party. That's you taking a job at the corporation. Second, there may be no opportunity to bargain over the terms at all. This contract of adhesion may be a take-it-or-leave-it proposition in which the only alternatives are adherence or rejection. That's an insurance contract, especially when the bank says you got to have it. If you don't, we won't give you the mortgage. Three, one party may be totally unfamiliar with the terms. One party may have the advantage of time and expert advice in preparing it, while the other may have no real opportunity to study it. That's your classic warranty card in the box. They prepare it. They make it. They study the law. Everything is put together for the benefit of General Electric. All they show you is the little card that you put your name, address, and phone number on and send it in. And you don't have any idea as to what the terms and conditions of the contract are. Now, analyzing the above, it can be concluded that the state and the individual are not equals. Although the individual is sovereign, the state has the power position as it exercises executive, legislative, and judicial powers and lords over the individual. The state dictates all of the terms to its feudal serfs through statutory legislation and administrative regulations. There is no opportunity to bargain over the terms of any contractual legislation. The individual is left with a vote between two evils, and the result of which is still evil, and input during legislative sessions, which is usually ignored. However, the majority of the committee members hold the individual who attempts to influence legislation by and through committee action in general contempt and scorn. Sometimes the individual is even ridiculed and scolded by the committee chairman. And third, the majority of people are not even aware that any contractual liability even exists from these statutes. The state is a corporate entity engaged in business, and the individuals of a state are the customers. You taxpayers are the customers. The state has and has been perfecting its business rules for years, while the taxpayer simply bends like a shaking reed in the wind. So the question which needs to be answered is, how does a statute become a contractual agreement? Where is the consent? And the answer should become and B, becoming obvious. It is the implied consensual contracts between the state, who make statutory contracts implied in law, and the people based upon a fiction of law and without the assent of the individual. You signed up for a marriage license years and years ago, and the legislature is constantly changing the rules with every legislative session, and they never give you any input. You never have any opportunity to even know what the terms and conditions are. So when Social Lady comes out there, rips off your kid, and puts him into foster care, the parents are sitting there dumbfounded, wondering what in the hell happened here. That's assuming, of course, that they even had the gumption to stand up and challenge Social Lady when she came to the door. They're just totally bewildered. They have put themselves into a contract. Social Lady is simply the enforcer of the state's laws, enforcer of the state's contract. Hey, I'm out of time here again. Children, we're going to have to leave it right there. And remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.